Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And welcome back to the House of Pod. My name is Kaveh. I am the host of this fun little humor adjacent medical podcast. I think probably the only medical podcast ever in the history of the internet. Don't check that. Today, we're going to learn about how to read and interpret studies. And we're going to talk a little bit about scientific research and what makes one good, what makes one bad, how it's misused. We're going to talk about why that's important, if it's not obvious. Joining me to do that, oh God, this is going to be a fun show. I'm so excited. I expect it to go off the rails within the first 5 minutes. And if it doesn't, I will be very pleasantly surprised. Let me introduce a couple of people that are going to be joining me. First, we'll start with Dr. Bobby Davari. Bobby, buddy, how are you?
I'm doing great.
Are you doing it? Yeah, are you?
Yeah, I'm so excited.
Are you comfortable? Are you relaxed?
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of fanboying right now over talking to an epidemiologist. You know,
like yeah, I know.
You know, they're just.
You think he's kidding, but he actually is like kind of into this. Yeah. That's why I had to bring him on. He's like does get off on this a little bit. Are you going to be like?
It's great. Epidemiologists are now actually a category of person that people recognize. Prior to the pandemic, usually you'd introduce yourself as an epidemiologist and people would be like, oh, yeah, skin doctor.
just that one layer. That's the only one you do.
That's yeah, because the epidermis is skin. Yeah.
Right, that's it.
Bobby, I'm glad you're here, buddy. Bobby's been on the show before, but I have more than Bobby joining me. We also have Will Poole. You may know him on the internet as Christy Yamaguchi Maine. Will, how are you, buddy?
I'm great. I'm great. A little sleepy. It's late. I'm on the East Coast of the United States, so I'm staying up past my bedtime to get to talk to, like you said, you're a skin doctor, and you're now a fully recognized class of person because so many people hate you now. Many people hate this class of person thanks to the past few years. I think you're like just as famous as. This group of healthcare workers are, you're just as much infamous with a whole sector of our political spectrum over here. So I am thrilled. I've never spoken to an epidemiologist in person before. We'll probably try you and, you know, in a court of law eventually if half of our political candidates ever, win and on their platforms and stuff. I'm stoked.
Well, I have actually have the dubious honor of having been personally, well, not by name, I don't think, but personally attacked by RFK Jr. in his book.
What? Holy shit. Wow. This is
congratulations. On me, I guess.
Man. Well, let's tell people who you are because they've been hearing you talk for a little bit. Joining us today, we have Gideon Meyerowitz-Katz, soon-to-be PhD epidemiologist from the University of Wollongong and a writer of a Substack. I mean, do I say a Substack writer? I'm not sure how to introduce that, but you do have a great Substack, and you have been very active online, and you give lectures, and you talk a lot about studies, research, what makes one good, what makes one bad. You talk about what's happening in the news, and you help people to understand it and dissect it. And I think it's a super important thing. So I'm very happy you're here to join us today. Thank you for coming.
It's my pleasure.
And as Will said, yeah, I mean, you know, a lot of people just hate you at this point, just based on your title. But I hope by the end of this episode, they hate you for you, not just for your title.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting one because, as I said, a lot of people didn't know what an epidemiologist was before the pandemic. And now most people assume that they're evil. Well, if you support certain political parties, you think they're evil. If you support certain political parties, you think they're good, at least in the United States. I think in Australia, there's no strong political angle to science, fortunately.
I'm so lucky.
Yeah, the major political parties, the two major political parties here are pretty much on the same page when it comes to public health measures. And then you've got the really fringe extremists who everyone ignores.
Okay, so first start by telling us a little bit about what an epidemiologist is, for those of us who don't know. And then let's talk a little bit about why it's become sort of a political thing here in the United States, at least.
I mean, epidemiology is just the study of human disease at population scale. So as opposed to, you know, like medicine, which is the study of how individual bodies work and the minutiae of physiology, which is completely beyond me, because I did a psychology degree and then I did a master's of public health, so I never did any of the kind of in-depth stuff of individual humans. But then epidemiology is just diseases across the population. So before the pandemic, all epidemiologists that I know have got pulled into the pandemic to some degree, and I was pulled in to a great degree. But before the pandemic, most of my work was in diabetes research and identifying population-level trends in type 2 diabetes. And that's a pretty standard epidemiological thing to do.
Well, then what's happened here that's caused the field of epidemiology to be so demonized, at least by some portion of our country?
I think basically the issue is that epidemiology is very involved with the spread of human disease. And in a pandemic, the epidemiologists are basically the experts in what's happening. And so a lot of the scientific decision, or a lot of the political decisions, were backed up with scientific studies produced by epidemiologists. And a lot of the people who were talking on television about the pandemic, because they were the experts in the matter, were epidemiologists. And I think a lot of people, particularly in the United States, who didn't like the way their politicians dealt with the pandemic, prefer to blame the scientists who were talking about the realities as they saw them. I think the part of the challenge is that, like, science, the politics and science are essentially different, because politics, you're trying to balance what people want to happen, and science, you're just saying this is kind of what will happen, this is what is happening, and this is what we would predict to happen if we followed these various scenarios. And sometimes you don't really care about the outcomes. What you really care about is what people are telling you to do, and that's politics, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas so then I think that disconnect is partly why people don't like epidemiologists right now. Mm-hmm. Or some people don't like epidemiologists.
We like you. You seem fine.
It's nice to be liked.
As of now, we like you. Yeah. By the end.
Well,
of
a lot of people online really, a lot of people online really hate me. So that's fine. I don't need to be liked anymore.
Every time I join one of these episodes, it's someone who like has just like the internet has a hateful rage boner for Kaveh. You have like such a cast of people that like which is just kind of like the climate in America right now. It's like if you are coming from the healthcare field and not saying exactly what you know people want to hear, then you're demonized to some degree. But whether it's talking about fentanyl exposure and all of the myths and bullshit surrounding by that, or Gwyneth Paltrow's grifting kicking ass, or now epidemiology. It's always someone who's hated by a large portion of the internet, Kaveh.
The previous episodes that you've been on, that was Ryan Marino and Jen Gunter.
Yeah, Ryan Marino for sure. It was about Florida's decision to teach what they're teaching and like the Don't Say Gay Bill and stuff.
That's so, right. Yeah.
But speaking of Florida, I have a Florida question for you, actually.
I know nothing about Florida specifically. Lots of alligators, I think.
No, you will enjoy this. There's I'm just curious because there's a new movement now called Medical Freedom. And it's really the epicenter is Florida, where they have hired doctors that are that you know are fired from their organizations for refusing to get vaccinated and so on, and want to prescribe ivermectin, and they've started their own healthcare system there based on alternative facts. So I wonder if anything like that's happening in your country and what your thoughts are on that.
What, first of all, where what is the Florida of Australia?
Yeah, what is the Florida? Is it Brisbane? I'm just guessing.
We don't have a Florida. New Zealand's pretty good.
Is that New Zealand?
We don't have a Florida exactly, because there's no like state that is.
You can say it. It's fine. I have like three. But like, okay, Florida.
Where do most of the Bogans live?
Ah, some great Australian terminology there. I mean, rural areas. Bogan and redneck are similar terms. I would say. If you're going to go for an American counterpart,
and I can say that term because I am one. Proudly have been my entire life. Come from a long lineage of them.
Rednecks
down here in North Carolina. I live in southeastern United States. So, I was excited to learn the term Bogan.
that's lovely. Now, Australia, the thing is, the states aren't as different from each other as in America, I would say, is kind of the thing. But like Queensland is kind of the Florida of Australia in a way, but Brisbane and Sydney are very similar cities, and 90%, not 90%, I think it's about 60% of Australians live in the state capitals of each state, which is very different to America.
Yeah,
so like,
for sure.
Brisbane is 2.2 million people, I want to say. And I think Queensland has about 4.5 million people total. So then.
Oh, wow. So, but speaking of this medical freedom thing, which is, hilarious and disturbing and terrifying. But what I find interesting is that they're still coming back to ivermectin. This is the thing I don't understand. Why does ivermectin still keep coming up? What is it about this drug that people love so much? I mean, tell me, let's just start with the data on it. Is it useful at all for treating COVID?
So ivermectin is the reason, one of the reasons why a lot of people online hate me, actually. So kind of an interesting story with ivermectin. What happened was in 2020, there was a fraudulent study that was later withdrawn that showed this huge benefit to ivermectin. This was well before most people remember, but it was in June 2020, if you remember the Surgisphere scandal. Surgisphere, they had a couple of papers in the New England Journal of Medicine and The Lancet saying that hydroxychloroquine was bad and didn't help. But they also had a preprint that was under consideration with The Lancet when all of the big scandal happened, where they said that ivermectin was good. And that preprint caused a number of countries in Latin America and in other places in the world to adopt ivermectin as a treatment pretty much overnight, because it's super cheap, super available in these countries, and it's relatively harmless as drugs go. And that caused a lot of people around the world to just start using ivermectin. And when that study was retracted because it was just a complete fabrication, I mean, the ball had already started rolling. And then what happened was later in 2020, a series of papers, randomized trials, came out. And these RCTs appeared to show huge benefits for ivermectin. And that kind of got a lot of people very excited. And this is kind of when Pierre Corey was saying in the US Congress that ivermectin is a miracle drug. You know, there was that really famous viral clip of him saying that it 90% reduction in death when using ivermectin. That came from this series of studies. And in 2021, myself, along with a group of colleagues who are, we're all researchers, but unaffiliated error checkers. I think we were referred to as scientific sleuths in a couple of things, but basically we're just random people who have, for one reason or another, got into error checking in science. We found that a large number of these ivermectin papers were fabricated, so they didn't happen. And about 5 or 6 of them have since been retracted after the authors either didn't have data or the data came back and it was clearly fraudulent. In one case, they had copy-pasted the same 11 patients over and over again in a data set and just manipulated the columns, the cells, to show a benefit for ivermectin. They later said their public comment was that it was an accidental work of fraud by a medical student. They created a fake data set to train a medical
student. Oh, they blamed the medical student. The most fundamental story in medicine. Blame the medical student.
This fake data set that they created for the medical student or by the medical student, accidentally, they just submitted this to the journal and never corrected that.
What the hell?
That's not normal. That story. Just so you know, Will, that's not normal.
That's not normal?
No, it's not. It's not
okay. Hopefully. So here's the question that I'm left with. Who stood to benefit from this fake study?
So that's not even the whole story.
Okay.
So all right. Wait, let me just finish the story first.
My bad.
So then we found that these fake studies, if you removed the fake studies from the literature, what you found was that ivermectin had a plausible benefit, but it was very small and not, it was consistent with no benefit. And then in 2021, people took this really seriously, right? They took this drug, this ivermectin, really seriously. And so a group of independent researchers started running massive randomized trials funded largely by philanthropic efforts and governments because pharmaceutical companies not super interested in off-patent drugs. So instead, they went to other funders and they got these funded through philanthropic efforts. And what they found was that ivermectin generally doesn't have a benefit in the treatment of COVID-19 and is unlikely to have a benefit in the prevention of COVID-19. So these are huge, diverse studies run by independent researchers with funders who are either charitable organizations, governments, or similar NGOs. And so the end result is that we now know that ivermectin is unlikely to have any benefit in the treatment of COVID-19 or the prevention of COVID-19. That's pretty much where the evidence is. But to answer your question, it's hard to say why people commit fraud, and I still cannot tell you exactly. But generally speaking, I think the main reason that people do academic fraud is just that it's a career boost. That seems like the most likely explanation for me. You get this study, and this study goes across the world. You get a big international reputation, and suddenly you get more money, more funding, more people interested in working with you.
Gotcha.
I mean, think about what we're doing. We're talking about this one bullshit study still from 2020, and we're not talking so much about like the 3 or 4 that have come since disproving it. You know, I mean, those aren't household names. We don't know who those people were. Like, that those are the ones that are those iconoclastic, right, that people, all these researchers want to be the person to put out that paper that goes against the paradox.
But it's like such a, I mean, I know I'm trying to apply logic to an illogical action, but like I still know Wakefield's name from the autism study on vaccines, and like in a negative way, like he will never live that down. I know, you know, as I'm saying that, he's still held up in certain circles as like a hero, you know, in anti-vax circles. But it's like you know that they're going to try to replicate something as miraculous as ivermectin being a cure for COVID-19.
Yeah.
And like, what do they think is going to happen? Has anybody ever, I know studies like slip by sometimes, but does anybody ever not get caught with this? Like bullshitting?
Oh, all the time.
All the time. Okay.
The challenge with scientific, there's a, an issue currently in the medical literature, which I've written about, which I'm working on several projects and looking at this, which is that fraud is currently largely ignored. Because within peer review, peer review is the major mechanism by which we assess scientific research. You submit a paper to a journal, the journal sends it to a group of your peers who are other people in the same field. They review it and they tell the editor their recommendations. Within that process, there is no mechanism by which to catch fraud. So if someone sends through a paper that is based on fake data, there is not like a statistical or mechanistic process to detect that that data is fake.
I think there's a guy out of England, Ben Goldacre, that was sort of a popularized this idea of help, like openly publishing your trials. I can't remember the what he, I think it's like opentrial.com or something like that, where you say what you're going to do before you start, and then you have to report whatever data you have. And I'm paraphrasing this horribly. You probably know more about this than I do, but he did a great TED talk on this, where he showed this thing called a funnel plot, where you look at the data from across all the different studies that are looking at the same question, and then if multiple groups come up with the same answer, then you can believe it. At least at that point, you can say it's less likely to be fraudulent. That's like one way of doing it. And then there's people like you who actually will go in there and look at that particular study, which, yeah, bless you for doing that. That is, I've tried to do that with medical residents, and it's so painful, and meticulous. And so yeah, if you are willing to do that, it's fantastic work.
So there are kind of two separate issues there. Ben Goldacre is big on what's called publication bias. And publication bias is where you have studies that are conducted, but they're not published. And that's very easy to do if you don't register your trials. So what's now common is, it used to be very common in the 90s and noughties that particularly pharmaceutical companies, but also academics, would run trials. They would never tell anyone they ran the trial, and if it was negative, they would just not publish it. And so a lot of the literature was unpublished. And it wasn't fraudulent, it just you would never know that these negative studies had been run and all of the studies were positive. And there are kind of all these mechanisms within academia to kind of incentivize people to only publish positive research, like a lot of journals really prefer positive studies. And that's a big thing. So what you do to prevent that is you pre-register your trial. As you said, you tell people what you're going to do before you do it. And then if you don't publish it, people can go back and go, well, look at all these unpublished trials. The key result in our plot isn't giving us the right number. But that's not fraud, which is what I was talking about.
If the study is fraudulent, though, it's not, it's unlikely to be replicated unless you have like multiple organizations across the world all doing fraudulent work at the same time. I mean, that would be a much harder thing to do,
So,
but does that happen? Has that
well,
happened?
there, firstly, well, in the ivermectin thing, yes, there were several organizations and they committed fraud in very similar ways. But the other issue is there was recently a paper that showed this. One fraudulent study can hugely change a meta-analysis result. So a meta-analysis, when you aggregate a number of different studies together and you use, there are a variety of statistical methods, but most of them are very vulnerable to a single really positive study. And if you commit fraud, you often exaggerate your results. So there was a study that found that on average, having a single fraudulent paper in a meta-analytic model exaggerated the result by at least 30%.
Oh
And
my
that's what
God.
happened with that one retracted study, right? That one retracted study on ivermectin worked its way into a meta-analysis or at least one and totally threw off the data on that. The point that you made before about publishing positive studies makes so much sense to me. Because if I think about it, when a study comes out and it's negative, most, I would say more doctors at least, tend to not read it thoroughly. They just kind of be like, okay, that was negative. They take the take-home point and that's about it. If it's a positive study, those are the ones that really want doctors want to read and like go through and be like, okay, is this like real? Is this like, but we kind of don't pay that much attention to the other one. So I could see why a publisher may not be as interested in doing that or sharing that.
And they also get fewer clicks. I mean, the New England Journal of Medicine, if you look at the studies they publish, most of them find a benefit. And then if you want to go to the studies that are negative, you have to go down the line to the less popular journals that don't get as many clicks.
It's literally the survivorship bias meme, the airplane with all the planes that were returning, they were seeing the gunfire and they thought, well, this is where we should reinforce the planes. But the ones that were shot down weren't returning, and so you actually needed the armor in the other places. It's the same thing with the only publishing the ones that are successful or have a benefit. If you're just hiding away your ones that crashed and burned, then you're not getting a full picture of what's actually going on.
That is a fantastic point, Will, but you're going to have to take a step back and explain to Bobby what a meme is.
What is a meme? What is this
Bobby,
meme you speak of?
So a meme is, how do you explain?
It's a term coined, I believe, by Richard Dawkins.
Richard
originally.
Dawkins and the God Delusion, I believe. It's an idea version of a gene passed on. So instead of you calling it a gene, it's called a meme. And the idea is that it jumps from person to person in their consciousness and kind of takes a different shape, slightly altered every time, so on and so forth, and kind of, I don't know if that's a
good
explanation.
That's actually pretty good. No, that's a pretty good explanation.
Okay, all right.
Just so you know, before you came on, Bobby was on, I had to explain to him that Christy Yamaguchi Main wasn't your real name and why it wasn't your real name, how it was a combination of names. It was a thing. I just so
yes,
we have to explain certain things to our
It's a portmanteau of my favorite figure skater of all time and one of my favorite Southern rappers of all time.
Nice, nice.
Oh, I thought it might be a portmanteau of Christy Yamaguchi and a Pokemon, but
that's
relative interest.
That's not a bad guess. Not a bad guess at all.
So, we've talked about this. The words have come up a couple times, RCT and meta-analysis. These are different types of studies that are done. We hear about this a lot. We hear about these different studies, I think, both in scientific, obviously, literature and in the medical world. But I think it's getting out there into the rest of the world with actual people, real people. And so, in your mind, is there a hierarchy to different types of research studies? Can you explain a little bit of that, at least between an RCT, what that is, and a meta-analysis, and what you think is perhaps more useful, or in what situations they're more useful?
So classically, if you search for hierarchy of evidence, what you'll come across is a pyramid of evidence where it's a bit weird because the pyramid doesn't actually make sense because the stuff on the bottom doesn't happen more often necessarily than the stuff on the top. So the idea of a pyramid is weird.
It's kind of a ladder.
It's more of a ladder, I guess. But anyway, so generally speaking, what people will say is that kind of anecdotes and opinion is at the bottom, and then poorly controlled studies, such as a case control study or study designs where there isn't a great deal of control, are next on that ladder. And then up further, you've got randomized control trials where you've got a great deal of control over the participants and what you're doing. And then finally, at the very top, you've got meta-analyses of randomized control trials. And I think that that's not a great way to think about scientific evidence, personally. There's a much better and slightly funnier pyramid of evidence created by a statistician on Twitter. I think it was Darren Daly who created it. And it's just... at the bottom is bad research, poorly done research, and then at the top is well thought through studies of any design. And I think that's a useful way to think about it, because really the thing about scientific evidence is that the studies that you that any study design can be the most appropriate study design for a particular question. So if we're talking a lot of the design of how we interpret scientific evidence is, or at least medical evidence, is based on drugs and pharmaceuticals. And if you're talking about pharmaceuticals, then randomized trials are the gold standard, because you can always test a pharmaceutical in a randomized trial. And if you're not testing in a randomized trial, it's questionable whether you're doing it right. And then you look at meta-analyses of randomized trials, because generally speaking, you can't conduct a single randomized trial that's big enough to answer the question well. So you look at all of the evidence across different RCTs. Now, that's not always the case. There are a few examples, such as the COVID-19 vaccine trials, where they were just big enough to answer the question. But most of the time, when we're talking about like one RCT, it's rare you'll have a randomized trial that's bigger than a couple of hundred people in each arm. But if we're talking about, say, what is the incidence, so the new number of new diagnoses of diabetes in high-income countries, a randomized trial is obviously not what you're looking for, because that's not a testing one treatment against another. What you do is you do large epidemiological studies where you randomly sample people from the population and see whether they have been diagnosed with diabetes recently. And that's something that the CDC does. It's something that the various European bodies, the NHS, whatever, the French medical, the French National Medical Service does. And so that's a different type of study. It's less controlled in many ways, but it is more appropriate for the question that you're asking. And that's really the point. Whenever you're looking at a study, I don't necessarily think that it's useful to say, well, this type of evidence is better. I think it's more important to consider what is the question that the authors are trying to answer, and is the study design that you're looking at appropriate to answer that question? It's a more difficult thing to do, but it's more useful.
Yeah, so I think one of the challenge, like, so I deal with patients like face to face, and you tell them about studies and so on, and you know, it's hard to get anything across, because once you start talking about statistics and you know, if they hear randomized, that may, they may interpret that as, oh, it's just random. You know, that's, what does that mean? You know, randomized, and so it's really hard to get across, you know, how important it is to wait for the science before doing something like starting a new medication, putting that in your body, like ivermectin. Like, wait for the data to come out. It's really, especially when people are, you know, when they're freaking out a little bit about what's happening around them. And then, you know, if you come into an office and the doctor starts talking to you about evidence and waiting for randomized trials, they can't really hear you. And so I just wonder if you have any advice for the patients that might be listening, or even the clinicians that might be listening, on, you know, how to be better consumers of their healthcare when they're to ask better questions of their physicians who are prescribing whatever it is for them. What are some good questions, and how do you approach it as a patient yourself when you go to the doctor?
Oh man, I'm the worst patient.
I can imagine.
Because, well,
someone,
be tough,
right? Oh man, I'd be
nervous.
Every single thing I'd have to. Yeah. Okay, let's talk about it. This is why I'm saying.
Yeah, well, often I leave the doctor and I go to the Cochrane collaborations.
That's right. Exactly.
I try not to look things up in front of people anymore because it's a bit rude, but it's not.
Wait, that's the epidemiologist version of like me using WebMD whenever I go to see my practitioner, right?
Yeah, except he actually does it accurately, and then
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
He can really come at you with like some serious questions. And, you know, I have to say, I have a few patients that are scientists, and they're lovely to work with, to be honest. It's been great. It's not, those are not my problem folks. It's the hardest folks are the people that, you know, are very impassioned and what's the right way, a PG way of saying this, they're just very vocal about their opinions about whatever it is, and they want what they want. And to say, well, listen, the number needed to treat just doesn't make sense here. Or if you say, well, there's no randomized controlled trials, they're like, what are you talking about, man? I want my medical freedom.
Is what they want ivermectin.
Yeah, well, a lot of times it's not even that. It's simple things like wanting antibiotics for, you know, a runny nose they had for 15 minutes. You know, oh my, I have a stuffy nose for, it started yesterday. Give me the big gun antibiotics. You know, I want, you know, Cipro for my sinusitis. Like, okay, I want Levaquin. You're like, well, where did you even hear that?
And that's the flip side. That's the flip side of like, of the movement where like, you know, teaching people to advocate for themselves, because there has been like a history in the past of like doctors not necessarily listening when people are speaking up about their, so like you can absolutely take that to the extreme and where they're asking for things that will not treat whatever symptoms they have or think they have. So yeah, there's definitely a two sides to that coin for sure.
No, that's a problem somewhat unique to the United States as well, I think, what you're describing, because the US is one of very small handful of countries that allows marketing of prescription medication direct to consumers. Yeah. So in Australia, people don't go to their doctor and ask for specific antibiotics. They might ask for antibiotics more broadly, but they won't go, I need this brand name because it will cure me straight away.
Well, listen,
yeah. So, how do I immigrate to Australia? And are you hiring? That's a when can
it's
I start?
It's challenging.
No,
well, as a doctor, I think it's not that hard actually.
I might have a
right
chance
now.
You couldn't, man. You couldn't leave the OC. You're so OC'd at this point. You're never.
Oh, they have beaches there too. I hear.
No,
we have excellent beaches.
This point though is really interesting because people have talked about it for years, like. Aren't you worried about medicine being taken over by AI at some point in the future? And I say no, and I'll tell you why. For one simple reason, it'll be too good. And like, someone's going to go to their AI doctor, their robot doctor, and they're going to put in like their problem, and the robot doctor is going to say, no, you don't need antibiotics. And they're going to be like, no, I need my medical freedom. Fuck this robot. Give me a human doctor. You know, that's what will happen. Like, it'll never work for that reason alone. So I feel.
And in
a
the
lot
future, they will also be able to fuck the robot. Like, that will be like we will have, like, the AI will have come that far, and we will have made medical advancements. So it's kill two birds.
Well, then
stone.
maybe they would have some more influence if they were able to do that.
Yeah.
They'll actually listen to whoever that AI is. But there actually is interesting. My mentor in medical school published a study, I can't remember the name of it now, but basically showing that doctors that were perceived as most satisfying to patients that had the highest satisfaction scores actually had the higher mortality and poorer outcomes.
UC Davis.
You adjusted for their comorbidities. So these are people that are equally sick. The doctors that were perceived as more pleasant or
the patients with the higher satisfaction of their doctor visit ended up doing more poorly.
Worse.
And the reason for that is they were getting tests they didn't need, showing them things they didn't need, being exposed to procedures they may not need, being exposed to medication that had side effects that they may not have needed. And the people who actually were a little bit less happy overall with their care did better.
that's the whole manifest destiny attitude of Americans seeping into parts of life that we are not experts in. We just want what we want. I mean, that's why we do so much shit that is bad for us. It doesn't matter. As long as we're satisfied in the moment, that's all we give a shit about.
Yeah, I was going to say, I would be interested to see if that study was repeated in like the EU, where healthcare is paid for by the government, and it's not. There's less demand for specific services.
Yeah.
I suspect you would find that satisfaction was related to different factors.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you would find a difference there, I'm sure. Hopefully. This move sounds more and more tantalizing now to go And you're convincing me. I have another follow-up question to that. How do you, as an epidemiologist, when you're seeing a doctor, what are your, maybe this would be interesting for people listening to know, how do you, are there clues you're looking for when you're talking to your doctor that tells you, hey, this is someone who I can trust, or I can...
Has done at least the research on this, has read up on this medication or this treatment.
I mean, so this is kind of, I didn't really answer your question before. I just said that I'm a terrible patient, but I think it's kind of related.
That's what we needed.
But yeah, because I think that personally as a patient, I like doctors who are honest about uncertainty.
Yeah.
And that's the sort of physician that I find easiest to work with and to talk about my health, because most questions in medicine are to some extent uncertain.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you may not benefit from any medication that you're prescribed because it's complex to understand exactly who will benefit from each medicine and how that works. We only have large trials which give us the average benefit. Doesn't always translate to the individual experience. Right. Or as I like to say, actually, my favorite example of this kind of point is acrylamide. Acrylamide is a chemical that likely causes cancer, and it is in everything. So it's in coffee, it's in olives, it's in prunes. It's caused by a reaction that happens when you cook carbohydrates, and also when you cook fats sometimes. So there's a small amounts of acrylamide in like a steak as well. And the thing is that it causes cancer very, very rarely. So at the intake for a general human person, based on coffee and all the various things you eat, I once calculated that you would expect to see somewhere in the region of 10 cancers in California, in the whole state of California, every 10 years, roughly 10 people who get cancer because of acrylamide. And it's almost impossible to remove from all these foods and drinks and things. So it's not a public health issue. It's a tiny number of people. But if you are one of those 10 people, you do not care about the statistics. The population perspective means nothing to the individual. It is just something, it's how the research world works.
And I like a doctor. Is the most powerful of all.
Exactly. If you're one of the 10 people who the bad thing happens to, you don't care that it's extremely rare. Yeah. You are just furious that it happened to you, and understandably furious that it happened to you. And I like to, whenever I see a doctor, I like to have someone who understands the uncertainty, the reality of medicine, in my opinion, that nothing is a given. And I also just like doctors who treat me like an adult. And I think that is, I have to say, mm-hmm. something that I personally think is likely to be true of everybody. No one likes to be talked down to or patronized in any context.
And you also bring up like this point that goes back to, Corey earlier going in front of Congress and saying that it was a miracle drug. Anytime a doctor refers to something as a miracle drug, I'm like, come on, stop. You know that's not the case. I mean, there's no miracle drug.
Isn't ivermectin for its intended use pretty awesome? Like it's like for what it was originally developed for, and its cost and its like availability in third world countries, like underdeveloped nations and stuff, for its intended use, I hear it's pretty, I won't say miraculous, but it's like Nobel Prize winning, right?
Yeah, like it literally did win a Nobel Prize. The reason why it's so amazing is because it's quite effective even at low doses, which are very, very safe. So you can give, prior to the pandemic, there were mostly in the late noughties and early noughteens, is that what we're calling them? I don't know what to say about the.
I've never heard anybody call it the naughties before, so that's a new one. I dig that. That's great.
You need to get on TikTok. It's the naughties these days.
The naughties and the naughties. Yeah. All right.
That's the slang of the youth. Anyway, in that period, like 2005 to 2015, there were a lot of these mass drug administration programs. And what they would do is they'd give ivermectin to every single person in areas of a country because a sufficiently large proportion of those people had parasitic infections, helminths, the type of, you know, worms that ivermectin treats. And you could give every single person one pill every 3 months or one pill every 6 months, and it would cause virtually no adverse events, so no people would die because you were giving them pills, and it would cure a reasonable proportion of them. And so it is in some ways miraculous for that purpose. You're right. It just doesn't work for COVID-19, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's the never-ending search for dual applications for things. So like whether it's a coffee enema, it's like or you know, or some other like stupid, you know, Instagram.
That is the worst. That is the worst example, a coffee enema. Coffee already had so many good uses.
I know, but yeah. Like, but we, there's this, it's like, you know, the search for the Holy Grail or the fountain of youth, or, you know, I've been diabetic since I was 9 years old. I'm type one. And, you know, there's tons of health books that say, if you just take, you know, ridiculous amounts of cinnamon, your blood sugar will come down.
Or apple like, cider vinegar, man.
Apple come cider on. Vinegar, some Bragg's apple cider enema. Vinegar and stuff. The number of, what, you know, even if they have some kind of like small beneficial, you know, like small amount of benefit, usually it's for type 2 diabetes that it's shown in studies. People just don't know what they're talking about, first of all. And second of all, everybody's desperate for some kind of holistic version of what they think is a miracle cure.
Yeah, my favorite example of that is Linus Pauling and vitamin C. I'm sure you know a lot about that, but it was, this is a guy who won the Nobel Prize and basically ruined his entire, career over this mad search for, the effectiveness of vitamin C at curing literally everything. But never really basically, but he basically started the whole vitamin, era where people take high doses of vitamins, and I think it was essentially proven to be total BS, and large studies have shown that, you know, using high doses of vitamins is essentially useless and actually could be harmful. But Linus Pauling won the Nobel Prize, like a really smart guy.
He didn't just win the Nobel Prize. He was one of the first people ever to win it twice. He won two. He had two Nobel Prizes.
We know very well now that there can be people who are really fucking smart at one thing, and it does not translate to other things, if it's a similar field. You know, I want to go back to something, though. You know, we're talking a little bit about like patient preferences, about whether or not they want someone sort of patronizing or telling them what to do and telling them exactly how it should be and be very concrete about it, versus someone who kind of understands the nuances of what's going on and tries to express that things are not always clear. And, you know, in our training, Bobby and I come from, even though we're ancient, come from a relatively newer form of medicine where we want the patient to be a part of the medical decision-making process. But I have found that doesn't work for everybody. Some patients don't want that. And Bobby, I want to hear what you have to say about this too. And I think that translates to how people are buying the ivermectin study. Because, you know, if you listen to a doctor who knows what they're saying about COVID or knows what they're saying about treatment for it, we talk with some degree of uncertainty. We have to, if we're being honest. We have to be like, well, the studies do look good, that the vaccines have worked for this reason, or the studies look good, you know, overall, that the masks work, but there is a little bit of, you know, there's a little bit of nuance to all those things, and
people don't like nuance.
To come in and say masks don't work, don't wear them. They want people to say the vaccine is deadly, it's going to kill you, don't take it, because it's almost easier to understand that, I think, for some people. I mean, I'm not saying everyone, but Bobby, do you feel like in medicine that you come across patients where they just want you to tell them what to do and they don't want to be a part of that decision-making process?
Yeah, I think that's the key for me is to, if you're, people don't care what you know unless they know you care, right? Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the benefit of family medicine. It's not like I just see these patients one time in the emergency room and never see them again. or an urgent care, or you know, a surgeon who might operate on you one time and then they'll never see you again, I get to have a relationship over time with somebody, so my influence can grow. So I have to be very careful about being, you know, a jerk to somebody and just dismissing their requests just out of hand, because I know that, you know, I want to be able to see that person again. And so, you know, you have to make these calculated decisions. Obviously, I try to, you know, be reasonable with the patients and explain to them why we're doing something or not something else. But yeah, most people do want to be involved. It's fewer now. I think in places, sounds like Australia or England, you can just kind of tell the patients, this is what we're doing, which would be nice. But I think that, you know, in modern day medicine in America, it's challenging. You know, people look at commercials, they want what they want from the commercials, they talk to their friends who they trust more than their doctor. But I think a plug for family medicine, the reason, you know, I went into family medicine is because I knew that the relationship is the most powerful part of the equation. Once you get to know somebody and you've had that time with them, then you really do have influence. And that's really fun. So, I think figuring out, like, it's so hard to know what kind of patient you have in front of you in one visit. It just takes multiple visits over a long time. So yeah, it's really hard to know for sure.
Yeah. And it's a good plug.
What you were describing earlier though, I just wanted to pick up on one point, which is you were talking about how it's much easier to be certain than uncertain. Yeah. And I think it's often described as the bullshit asymmetry principle. Mm-hmm. It's much easier to say things that are not true with a great deal of certainty than to be appropriately uncertain about the advice you're giving.
Yeah, there was a guy, what's his name? Yeah, Nate Silver. He wrote a book, Signal for the Noise, where he looked at pundits on TV who made predictions about what was going to happen either geopolitically. And then he found that the ones that were the loudest and on more channels and were carried by more news organizations were the most likely to be wrong.
Well, speaking of guys who were good at one thing and then failed miserably afterwards. Yeah. Thanks for bringing Nate Silver up into this.
Well, there you go. That's more evidence of what you were talking about before with that study where the most favorable the ratings for doctors had the highest mortality.
Right. Right. Wait, what happened with Nate Silver? I don't know I don't know what the prologue is. What happened to that? What happened to him?
His model failed.
Gideon, you want to take this?
Yeah, Gideon, talk to me.
Nate Silver has been a very loud voice on COVID-19, and he often says things with a great deal of certainty that are incorrect on Twitter.
Yeah.
Bobby hasn't been on the internet since MySpace, so he doesn't know these things. You're going to have to tell him this. Or Friendster.
I wouldn't say Nate is constantly incorrect. I would just say that he appears to have minimal understanding of the epidemiology, which leads him to say things very confidently that are
lots
incorrect.
Of confidence.
He got gassed up by the pop science crowd, and you know, the same crowd that gassed up people like what's his name, the 10,000 hours dude, Malcolm Gladwell.
Oh, Gladwell.
My god, Malcolm Gladwell.
They I could only imagine
Wait,
your
is
opinion
gassed
of
up bad or good. What's gassed up mean?
So okay. basically, like, you know, hyping you up into doing dumb stuff, you know, like your boys are standing around going, yo, man, come on, do it, you know, come on, like egging you on. And then, like, you know, kind of filling your ego, gassing you up a little bit. And then you end up, you know, driving off the cliff of stupidity.
you end up jumping off a bridge into the water and breaking.
Yeah, exactly.
That's like when I know how things are. Bob and Gladwell, the enema.
Yeah. Malcolm Gladwell is the reason I can't read pop science books anymore. The problem is once you start fact checking that stuff, you just realize that it's all nonsense. It's wrong or it's just completely unsupported.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, I've been doing all this shit for 10,000 hours for no reason.
It. Completely arbitrary number. Meaningless.
I'm sorry, you're never going to be in the NBA, Bobby. I'm sorry, man. Sorry, dude.
I mean, it was a brilliant. It was wasted. He is brilliant. I mean, at the marketing of it, there's a branding to that 10,000 hours that just really stuck.
And he had some fun ideas that if they just stayed in the hypothesis, just like you're just like kind of bullshitting in conversation about like the idea of stickiness and like the early adopters of something and kind of how like ideas spread, that's completely fine. Once you venture into other scientific fields that have like people that know what they're talking about, easily dispel what your theories are, then it runs off the rails.
You got off the kind of thing.
He's a brilliant writer and he tells a fantastic story. The problem is those stories generally don't have facts to back them
up. Right.
Yeah. The thing is, though, I would say 9 out of 10 books that you can buy, like at a, you know, you get like the stores in an airport where they sell the top 10 stay away popular from science books.
Yeah.
Most of those books will lie to you. That's my advice.
I have a question. What's a good one that you would recommend that is thorough on the research?
Oh man, I don't really read them anymore because every time I do, read a couple of chapters and just throw it at the fucking wall. The last one that I read was a book. Actually, Jen Gunter's book. If you're interested in lots of facts about vaginas,
yeah,
great book.
Yeah,
I prefer to keep it a mystery. In my opinion, like I am not interested in a lot of facts about that. It's more like I like the magical idea of it, and you know, just kind of a little mystery.
Well, just
there was a good one called Pain and Prejudice by a journalist in Australia. She wrote about endometriosis and women's experience of pain in the medical system. That's another fact-based book.
That's a good one. Yeah, I've got a couple for you.
Okay.
Yeah, maybe we can get some responses here, reaction. But I think Paul Offit is a fantastic author, OFFITT, and he wrote this one called Bad Advice, which I thought was really good, and Overkill, where he kind of reviews the evidence, but for the lay public, about various things that are offered in the medical system and that your doctor might offer you, and for you to understand whether or not it makes sense and see what the evidence is. But he does it for the lay reader, so you'll understand it. But his name is Paul Offit. I think he's fantastic. I don't know if you've read any of his work, but I think he's great. And he's actually
quite a reliable.
Yeah. Yeah, and he actually wrote a chapter on talking to the media as a scientist, which I thought was really interesting. And he's done a couple interviews about that, which is super interesting. And you know, we're just like not great at communicating like a Malcolm Gladwell or, you know, or someone on Fox News. Like, you just can't compete with those guys. So, you know, you can't. It's so hard to do. But
yeah, it's why we don't. It's one of the many reasons why I don't recommend debates, you know, in that setting, because you know, we're just not good at communicating that sort of thing. We're not designed for it. It's a rhetorical skill that most people who are great at science don't necessarily have, or really should.
I mean, it's why I voted for Dr. Oz, you know?
Yeah, twice.
I'm not, I don't even live in his district. I just wrote him in on all my ballots.
Well, you know, speaking of that, though, let's get back to one last thing before we let you leave, Gideon. What was the deal with RFK? What did he refer to you for? What was that about?
Oh,
and could you kick his ass?
I have absolutely no idea. I used to do Krav Maga years ago in MMA, but that was a decade ago when I was before I started my PhD. I did a lot more things, and then I started doing PhD.
And you're Australian.
And working
that gives you a few like
you can take
like,
a couple more hits than the average.
You live in one of the most hostile environments on the entire earth. So I feel like that hardens you to a degree.
That is a myth. Sydney is a beautiful city with very few poisonous. Well, there is
giant
the most
spiders,
poisonous
everywhere.
Venomous spider in the world. The Sydney funnel web is
so
the
just
most
that.
Venomous
just
spider.
You know, just that. You know, it's,
unless okay, you gotcha. Go like occasionally I go climbing outdoors in the mountains, and we go up to the Blue Mountains, and you have to be careful where you put your hands in the holds because sometimes there's a funnel web and you could get bitten. Aside from that, it's very rare to see a funnel web around.
Fair, sure. Okay.
They're pretty big spiders. They live in holes that are in the ground covered by webs. So unless you really like go for it, it's pretty hard to get bitten.
So speaking of dangerous creatures that live in dark holes, tell us about the RFK thing.
Yeah, yeah. Yes. So yeah, RFK, it was the ivermectin stuff. So the reason why I've been attacked publicly by various people is all the ivermectin stuff. I think I made it into his book briefly. I don't know if he referred to me by name, but this group of colleagues and the stuff that we published proving that several of these studies had been faked, that was referenced as some sort of evil plot. People think, for some reason, people can't believe that as a scientist who's primarily funded by the Australian state and federal governments, I might find it problematic that there's fake research published. Oddly enough, a colleague and I did publish a study showing that one of the large vaccine studies on Sputnik had some issues, and no one ever
shocker there.
Yeah, but no one ever goes, oh, you must hate vaccines because you've proven that Sputnik is problematic. They just go, oh, you hate ivermectin.
Russians.
Yeah, so that's why RFK doesn't like me.
All right, well, that's a good thing. I mean, it's not a great thing, I think, if he likes you. All right, let's close up there. Let's get a bunch of plugs in. Let's start, Gideon. Please plug whatever you want to plug. Let's plug it.
Well, the things that I'm currently doing is that I've got this. I'm writing a Substack, so if you like science and all that sort of stuff, you can find me on Substack as Gideon MK Health Nerd. You can also find me on Medium if you prefer Medium as a platform. I'm currently doing both, and I'm on Twitter. Sorry, X. It's at GidMK, GIDMK. And I'm also on TikTok at GidMK Health Nerd. So basically, whichever platform you prefer, except for Instagram, because I don't want to go on Instagram.
Yeah, it's a lot. It's a lot. Will Poole, aka Chrissy Yamaguchi Main, where can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter, because I refuse to call it X, at the yes. Waffle House, THEWAPPLEHOUSE. And you can also listen to my show, Jort Center. It is not a show about sports. It's about everything but, basically. It's just five long-term friends talking about a little bit of everything. And I enjoy doing it. So come follow, take a listen, Jort Center Pod.
I enjoyed listening to it.
Thank you so much.
Bobby Shahryar. Bobby's real name is Shahryar, by the way. Yeah. Shahryar. I'm not going to give you, you know what? I'm not calling you Bobby anymore on the show. Shahryar.
Shahryar is a cool ass name.
Yeah. Thank you. Right.
I was wondering why we were calling you Bobby when your screen name is Shahryar.
Bob Shahryar.
Yeah. Do you want to plug anything?
Yeah. What do you have to plug, man?
I have a Friendster account that's still live and a MySpace. No. No, I would just say I think those books. I would read, if as a patient, I would read those two books. I think those are really good. Bad Advice and Overkill. I think those are two good books by Paul Offit, and I think he's a really great person to follow in the media as well. If you want to look for someone who's got, you know, some real brains and is doing some media stuff to teach patients what's going on and what's what. So I would just do that, and then if you really want to see me, you'd have to get really sick and come to the hospital. That's another way to do it in Orange County.
I'd have to get on several flights as well.
He's several worth it. Flights, yeah. He's a good doctor. He's a good doctor. He's one of the people I turn to for help. what's this rash, Bob? Anyways, thank you all so much. It's such a blast having you all together. If you are interested, you can follow me at Twitter if you like, at the House of Pod. And I'm also on Blue Sky at CaveMD. But more importantly, leave a review of the show. I will read them. This one comes from Firecop019. Maybe not all cops are bastards. Great content. This has become one of my favorite podcasts. It feels like having a conversation with a friend. Hey, it's me. Talking about those topics that we really wish we could just get better. Sarcasm, humor, and discussion make this easy to listen to. Keep up the good work. You got it, Firecop. You keep fighting fires and arresting them or whatever it is that you do. Appreciate it. Thank you so much. Thank you to Nadine for help with production. You guys have been awesome. I love you.
Wool like wool.
But it's
like
wool as in sheep's
wool.
It's wool
and a gong. It's the Australian
wool
version of Cheech and Chong.
Gong.
This podcast is not a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Please consult a physician or other qualified healthcare provider for your specific healthcare needs or concerns. The opinions expressed on this podcast do not represent the opinions of our employers. Details in the podcast have been changed so that patient identification is not possible. And I'm alive.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns. Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.